can speak into our lives. So here we are, a bit of background for you just before we come here to our reading this evening. So David, mighty David, the greatest king of Israel, has died, and he's passed on the kingdom to his son Solomon. And David and Solomon, that kind of that era, represents really the pinnacle in many ways of the nation of Israel. They've defeated all of the enemies around them. They're kind of in national terms, they're standing over all of the other nations around them. You have this tremendous beginning to Solomon's reign where he God meets with him in a dream and asks him for whatever, you know, he will bless him with whatever he asks for. And Solomon asks for wisdom. He doesn't ask for riches. He didn't ask for power. He asks for wisdom. And God is so encouraged by that as a thread that he blesses him, and he blesses him with power and riches as well as wisdom. And you have him visited by the Queen of Sheba, and he's a great celebrated character. And you have a whole section just before our reading where it talks about Solomon's splendor and how wealthy he is and how much power and money he possesses. But then it says in 1 Kings chapter 11, if you've got your Bibles with you, in 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 1 to 3, it says, King Solomon, however, never a good kind of sort of thread there, never a good word that one, is it? King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. Well, I don't think it matters, you know. I didn't think it particularly mattered that how many wives he had, whether they were foreign or not. If you've got 700 of them and 300 concubines, it's pretty hard to figure out how he was not going to be led astray anyway. But it was the fact that a lot of these ladies actually came, they were from foreign nations, and they worshipped foreign gods, and they brought the worship of those foreign gods into Israel and into the king's kind of situation. So this is the kind of the scene that we have. Solomon, this great, he's had such a fantastic start to his reign, seriously displeased God by chasing after foreign women and foreign gods. And so we have our introduction, as was read by Julie. And I'm going to reread it because I want to, this is a very important part of the narrative, and I want to really kind of for us to go over this ground. So we're introduced to this character, Jeroboam. Jeroboam was an Ephraimite. And one of the things that I learned just in my recent studies is that the two tribes, Judah and Ephraim, if you look back at the end of Genesis, you will see that Jacob blesses his 12 children. But there is particular blessing. The first and the second sons are passed over because of the way that they behaved. In fact, the first three are passed over. But Judah and Joseph's son, Ephraim and Manasseh, the tribe of Joseph and Judah, are particularly blessed by God. And as the nation of Israel kind of formed, those two were very much the strongest clan, and if you look at the history of Israel, they're often seen to be jockeying for position. And so is it a coincidence? Probably not, that Jeroboam was an Ephraimite. And he rebels, it says in verse 27, against the king. Solomon had built the terraces and filled a gap in the wall, begun all these fantastic projects. And we're introduced to Jeroboam as a man of standing. What do you think of when you think of a man of standing? Was it because he was from a powerful, wealthy family? We know he was an Ephraimite, and so that was a very powerful clan in Israel. Perhaps his particular offshoot of that tribe was a very powerful one. We know that from living in our own nation today, that there are many families which are very powerful families. Was it because of his bearing? Sometimes people in leadership have a particular bearing about them, don't they? People are talked about in terms of perhaps they're presidential. They have a kind of a gravitas or an authority. Maybe he had something about him, although he was only a young man. Was it because he had that spark of inspiration? Some people are just inspirational, are they not? We probably know inspirational characters, perhaps amongst our friends or amongst those that we know, or in society. Any which way, he was a man of standing, and he came to the notice of Solomon. And it says in my version of the Bible, when Solomon saw how well the young man did his work, he put him in charge of the whole labor force of the tribes of Joseph. So he gave him a position of responsibility. So this is our background. We've had our background and we've been introduced to our character, Jeroboam. But Jeroboam's life is just about to be turned upside down. It says in 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 29, about that time Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah, the prophet of Shiloh, met him on the way, wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Then he said to Jeroboam, "Take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I'm going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes." What a day. I mean, we've got this character, Jeroboam. He's already a man of standing. He's already a significant player, if you like. He's quite a character. He's been given a responsibility by Solomon. And yet, all of a sudden, a prophet. Is he a false prophet? Is he a true prophet? We find that out later. But this guy comes to him, and he's a prophet, and he says, God says, I'm going to give you 10 tribes. I'm going to split the kingdom, and I'm going to give you a chunk of this kingdom. What about that? I mean, have you ever had days like that, life-changing days in your life? I know certainly for me, there have been a number of kind of very influential people that I've met in my life. Maybe not as dramatic as this, someone tearing up their cloak in front of me and kind of giving me a prophecy like that. And yet, I remember a guy who was pretty mad character as a young man who became a monk. And it stopped me in my tracks, and I used to go and visit him. And he had a huge influence in turning my life. I picked up the Bible as a result of this guy. I was on a journey, on a tube train up in North London. Really in a bit of a state in my life, really in a bit of a mess. And someone reached out to me on the underground. Someone evangelized me on the London Underground. And over subsequent meetings, showed me that I really was at a crossroads in my life, and I had an opportunity to go God's way or a different way. And I remember that character had a very, very dramatic impact on the way that my life went. Maybe you can think of some characters in your own life that have done that for you. But this further on, it says to this prophet says very clearly to Jeroboam, there's a reason I'm doing it. It's not because of how clever you are. It's not because of how big a standing you've got or how sort of influential or inspirational you are. He says there's only one reason why I'm doing this. Verse 33, it says, I will do this because they, or my footnote says he, as in Solomon, have forsaken me and worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the goddess, god of the Moabites, and Molech, and so on. There's a very clear reason, Jeroboam, why you're getting this amazing charge, why you've been given this amazing opportunity. It's because Solomon has started chasing after foreign gods. I want us to remember that because it's significant. There's something else, though, about this situation. It says a little further down, in verse 37, however, as for you, I will take you and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will become king over Israel. If, and this is the significant thing, if you do whatever I command you and walk in obedience to me and do what is right in my eyes by obeying my decrees and commands, as my servant David did, I will be with you. And hear this promise. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David and will give Israel to you. This guy Jeroboam, I mean, he's a man of standing. He's obviously an influential character. But all of a sudden, he's on the par with David. He's got the same promise that David had from God. Again, I don't know how you view your own life, who you think you are, or whether you think you're something special or you don't, and you kind of... But imagine being given that charge, like Mary was. When Mary came to, you know, when God came to her and said, Mary, you are going to be the mother of God. You are going to give birth to the Son of God. Imagine being given that kind of that charge, that responsibility from nowhere, out of nothing. In verse 40, it says then Solomon, who obviously heard about this encounter and heard that Jeroboam had this prophecy, he tried to kill Jeroboam. But Jeroboam fled to Egypt to Shishak the king and stayed there. So we have now this kind of, with this situation where this great kingdom now with under Solomon, you have this dramatic turn. It started so well, it's gone off the rails. Now it seems like there's a very different plan that's being set up there. Solomon goes and dies and is succeeded by his son Rehoboam. Beginning of chapter 12. It says, Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone there to make him king. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this, he was still in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon. He returned from Egypt. So they sent for Jeroboam, and he and the whole assembly of Israel went to Rehoboam and said to him, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten the harsh labor and the heavy yoke he put on us, and we will serve you. A couple of very interesting things here. Jeroboam's had this promise. When Solomon dies, you know, I'm going to rip this out and I'm going to give it to you. And you'd think Solomon has died. And perhaps that Jeroboam now would have taken up the kind of, you know, he would have gathered these tribes together and said, right, off we go. We're going to fight against this guy. But he doesn't. And the text doesn't tell us why he doesn't do that. But I mean, certainly one of the options is that it was God that said he was going to do this, and so he's waiting on God, that he's not going to take matters into his own hands and try and, you know, grab this forcefully at this point, that he's going to wait for God to do what, you know, God has said he was going to do. Not sure whether that's kind of what happened, but nevertheless, we have this showdown. And what's intriguing about this as well, this language, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but now lighten that harsh labour and the heavy yoke. This is the language of Pharaoh and the Israelites in Egypt, is it not? Moses appeared to Pharaoh and said, let my people go, you know, release them from this yoke. And this language, all of a sudden, Rehoboam has become this Pharaoh kind of character and has the people appealing, the Israelite people appealing to him. So we've got a showdown. We've got Jeroboam saying, you've got a heavy yoke, you've put a heavy yoke on us, and you've got Rehoboam there as the character, his rule perhaps under threat. This character that his father tried to kill. Very interesting here. In verse 5 it says, Rehoboam answered, go away for 3 days and then come back to me. So the people went away. And I don't know if you've ever been on the spot, all of a sudden been challenged, been kind of threatened, or it's something that's felt like a threat. Oftentimes you make a decision, you know, to fight straight back against that, or you shoot from the hip, you do something kind of perhaps that you'd regret later. I think Rehoboam here is very sensible, he's very clever in saying, hey, okay, heard you, let me go away and consider. That seems to me very measured, very, very sensible kind of way of dealing with it. And he goes to seek advice. Young people in the room, be prepared. I'm afraid you get a bad rep in the next part of this story. So it's not me. These are the words of God. Please don't take it out on me. But it's there here in the text. So what happens? Then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who had served his father Solomon during his lifetime. How would you advise me to answer these people? How would you respond to this threat? He asked. They replied, if today you will be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favorable answer, they will always be your servants. But Rehoboam rejected the advice the elders gave him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him and were serving him. He asked them, what is your advice? How should we answer these people who say to me, lighten the yoke your father put on us? The young men who had grown up with him replied, these people have said to you, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter. Now tell them, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions. Ouch. I don't know if you've ever been in a situation like this where you've been fresh in a responsibility, fresh in authority. Maybe you're kind of quite young in that situation anyway, quite insecure about your own authority, your own situation. There's a real challenge, there's a real tendency, isn't there, to want to throw your weight around, to feel the need to impose yourself on that situation. Have you ever been in situations like that? Anyone in positions of responsibility? It's a real challenge. I mean, I think of teachers, perhaps, you know, young teachers in situations. You go into a classroom, you've got this leery bunch of youngsters in there. It's really difficult not to feel the need to really impose yourself and to kind of, you know, to crack down, to let them know who's boss. And here you have this character, Rehoboam. He knows already from Jeroboam and his relationship with his father, this guy is a big threat to him potentially. So the obvious thing really is to want to take this guy on and to fight. And the advice, it seems to me, must have seemed to him is, right, I can be strong, you know, and not accept this kind of this threat, this kind of this ultimatum from, you know, from these people, or I can be weak. You know, I can say, oh, all right then, and I'm effectively kind of, you know, then enthralled to these people. And that, it seems to me, must have seemed how it was to him. And so when he gets his advice from his fellow, you know, youngsters, nah, take him on, come on, you're the man. That must have been very difficult to resist instead of these old fogies who say, nah, steady, you know. But it seems to me also that there weren't two courses of action, be strong or be weak. It was be brutal, be tough, be weak, or this third way that the elders advise him is be a servant. Leadership is not actually about just imposing authority on people. It's not just about stamping down on them and letting them know who's boss. That might be authority in some regards in our world, but certainly it's not real leadership. And certainly not the kind of servant leadership that you see, for example, more in David, and certainly see in Jesus. It's servant leadership, where he's there to serve, and he has this opportunity to be this servant king, humble before God. But what happens? Not surprisingly, in verse 12, 3 days later, Jeroboam and all the people returned to Rehoboam, as the king had said, come back to me in 3 days. The king answered the people harshly. Rejecting the advice given him by the elders, he followed the advice of the young men and said, "My father made your yoke heavy. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions." So the king did not listen to the people, for this turn of events was from the Lord, to fulfill the word the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through Ahijah the Shilonite. So this prophet was not a false prophet. He was a true prophet. He spoke the words of God. And here we go. God has delivered, if you like, Rehoboam into Jeroboam's hands. When all of Israel saw the king refused to listen to them, they answered the king, "What share do we have in David?" That's the tribe of Judah. "What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, O Israel. Look after your own house, David." And so Rehoboam is then installed as king. He's had this amazing visitation from a prophet who's promised him, God is going to give you the kingdom of Israel. He's not gone and grabbed it. He's been faithful to God's word. He stuck with the promises. God, sure enough, through the poor advice of his leery lads around him, Rehoboam has handed him this opportunity. Rehoboam is now installed as king of Israel. If only the story ended there with him being faithful to God. But this is where the behaving badly bit now comes in, because sadly it takes a bit of a turn. We'll pick up again in chapter 12, verse 26 and 27. Jeroboam thought to himself, "The kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam." So remind yourselves of the situation. He's here. He's got it all. He's been given this charge by God. He has it in his hands. He has God's blessing. He has the kingdom. All he's got to do is stick with God's advice. All he's got to do is keep his focus on God. All he's got to do is keep faith and not his own kind of, scheming or whatever in mind. But he gets thinking. Do you know what? Oh, this doesn't look good. I'm not so sure about this anymore. I know God promised this, but this is what it looks like. All the people, because Jerusalem is still the place where people have got to go to worship. If they go to worship in Jerusalem where Rehoboam is, they're going to transfer their allegiance to Rehoboam and they're going to hoof me out. That doesn't look good, does it? I've got to do something about that. Yeah, never mind what God said to me. Never mind what I was promised. I think I've got to do something about this. Tell you what, here's an idea. I'll go and seek some advice from some other fellas. After seeking advice, the king, verse 28, the king made two golden calves. He said to the people, "It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, Israel, who brought you out of Egypt. One he set up in Bethel, the other in Dan." What's he thinking? How did it go for the Israelite nation last time they made a golden calf? Do you remember that bit? How did it go for Solomon when he chased after the foreign gods? What was he thinking? What on earth? How could he have blown it? He's there, he's got the lot, he's got God, God's promised, God's delivered. How could he blow it? How do you blow it? I believe you're here tonight because you're seeking God. You're seeking God and you're a follower of God, or you're seeking God and maybe you want to be a follower of God. So perhaps you know God's promises and you know God's ways and you know what's right and you know what you ought to be doing. Do you always do it? We don't, do we? Somehow, despite knowing what we ought to do, somehow we still take those wrong turns and make that daft move. Sometimes it's temptation. Sometimes it's our thinking. And this is what I really want us to go away with tonight, is to reflect on your thinking. We are blessed. We have been unbelievably blessed. We're blessed knowing God, having been restored to a right relationship with God because of Jesus. We're blessed on so many different levels. We're blessed living in this country, living at this particular time, you know, in the nations, in the world's history. We're blessed. We're so blessed. And yet it's so easy, despite that, for our thinking to head off in the wrong direction. And as I was thinking about this myself, it seemed to me that we have God's way. There is God's way which is known to us. Most of us know right and wrong. Most of us, even if we don't pick up the Bible on a regular basis, even if we don't get good advice from Christians, we pretty much know right from wrong. There's God's way, and then there's our way. And our kind of scheming, calculating, shove that off to them. I think I've got a better way, you know what? I think I've got a better idea. And then it seems to me there's a third way, which is just kind of autopilot. And as I thought about what affects my thinking and how does my own thinking work, so much it occurred to me of what we do is just autopilot. We're not really thinking kind of dramatically, is there a right or wrong thing to do? We just go about our lives, aren't we? We're brushing our teeth, or we're getting on the bus, or we're kind of doing the ironing, or we're just going through a whole raft of what we perhaps consider to be mundane things. We're not even thinking about whether there's a right way or a wrong way to do this. And apart from the ironing, obviously, where clearly you have to iron, you know, this way, which is God's way, and not that way, which is... So much of what we do is kind of, you know, we're not thinking about this right or wrong. And yet there are times, are there not, in your day when you know the good you should be doing and you choose not to do it. Or your head gets turned and you allow yourself to go that way. Sadly, Jeroboam blows it. And down now in verse 30 of chapter 12, it says, "And this thing became a sin. The people came to worship the one at Bethel and went as far as Dan to worship the other. Jeroboam built shrines on high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. He instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the festival held in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. He did this in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves he had made. And at Bethel he also installed priests at the high places he had made. On the 15th day of the 8th month, the month of his own choosing, he offered sacrifices on the altar he had built at Bethel." Verse chapter 13, verse 1, it says, "By the word of the Lord, a man of God came from Judah to Bethel, as Jeroboam was standing by the altar to make an offering. By the word of the Lord, he cried out against the altar, 'Altar, altar, this is what the Lord says. A son named Josiah will be born to the house of David. On you he will sacrifice the priests of the high places who make offerings here, and human bones will be burned on you.' That same day the man of God gave a sign. 'This is the sign the Lord has declared. The altar will be split apart and ashes on it will be poured out.' When King Jeroboam heard what the man of God cried out against the altar at Bethel, he fell on his knees in repentance. He realized what he'd done. He realized how grievously he had sinned and how he had turned away. He repented. From that point onwards, he lived a... It's not what it says. Unfortunately, it said, when King Jeroboam heard what the man of God cried out against the altar of Bethel, he stretched out his hand from the altar and said, "Seize him!" But the hand he stretched out toward the man of God shriveled up so that he could not pull it back. Also, the altar was split apart and its ashes poured out according to the sign given by the man of God by the word of the Lord. Then the king said to the man, "Intercede with the Lord your God and pray for me that my hand may be restored." So the man of God interceded with the Lord and the king's hand was restored. You know, this is what's incredible about our God, is despite the fact Jeroboam had it all and then blew it, God still gives him a way out. He still gives him a warning. He doesn't just, you know, take him up in a puff of smoke there. He gives him this dramatic demonstration, this opportunity to change. And I thank God so much for those opportunities to change, because I seem to get lots of them, thank God, in my life. I hope you do too. When you head off down a wrong path and you fall foul and you mess up, then you still get another chance then to head back the right way. And this Jeroboam has this opportunity again here. But very sadly, the way this kind of this story, as we're going to end it this evening, says at the end of chapter 13 in verse 33, even after this, Jeroboam did not change his evil ways, but once more appointed priests for the high places from all sorts of people. Anyone who wanted to become a priest, he consecrated for the high places. This was the sin of the house of Jeroboam that led to its downfall and its destruction from the face of the earth. If you want to go on and read what happens to the house of Jeroboam, you'll see in the next few chapters of 1 Kings what happens. And it's shocking. I mean, once God has made his mind up, once, you know, a threshold has been crossed, there are terrible, terrible consequences. And we ought to be sobered and kind of and warned and take heed. There does come a point, despite God's grace and mercy, where we run out then of opportunities. And I think quite often the further down a path we go, the farther it is to come back. And sometimes, even though we have a chance to come back, it just seems too far now. I'm too far gone. And that's, you know, woe that we might find ourselves on that path. The bit that really grabbed me about this story, I mean, I hope you've enjoyed the narrative. I hope you've enjoyed the story, this just magnificent storytelling that the kind of the Bible gives us. I hope you've seen those clear paths that do kind of open up in front of us in our lives and we'll kind of focus. But what I really want you to go away with is your thinking. Is when those thoughts, those daft thoughts, those calculating, scheming, clever thoughts, I think I've got a better way, come in. Can you recognise those and haul yourself back? No, I'm going to go with God. I'm going to go with faith. God is, you know, I'm going to go God's way instead of my way. And my prayer would be, as a result of us looking at Jeroboam, at this another saint that's gone bad or behaving badly, that we might learn from him. And next time you're at that crossroads, make the right kind of, the right call and make the right turn. We're going to...